This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we are scheduled to hear from Doug Baker from the Department of Revenue. He and others representing the Jindal administration have been out on the hustings the last few days denouncing a tax compromise plan, budget deal that was in the works with House Republicans and House Democrats. It appears that House GOP members are now backing away after being given a talking to by the governor. We'll talk to Doug Baker about this reversal, of course. I'm sure he's happy about it. And it appears the governor still has some mojo despite his declining poll numbers. Also on the show, Brenda Elsegier, comedian, author, national speaker. She's a 17-year colon cancer survivor, and she's in Baton Rouge to tell her remarkable triumph over cancer. All this, now the news on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. Outside our area, 877-217-5757. You may reach us by email, inkstershow@wrkf.org. In just a bit, we'll have all things legislative, in particular the budget. We'll talk with the man from the Department of Revenue, Doug Baker. But we start with Brenda Elsegier. She's a comedian, author, and national speaker. She's a cancer survivor, particularly colon cancer. And tonight, Cancer Services of Baton Rouge has put together an event at the Pennington Center, 6 o'clock. It's a colon cancer awareness event. And Brenda is the keynoter. And she is a person who has delighted audiences all over the country with her compelling story, was voted the Twin Cities Funniest Person in Minnesota, and Newsmaker of the Year by the Women's Press, and received the Golden Mike Award from the American Cancer Society and the Advocacy to Action Award by the Get Your Rear in Gear organization. Good morning, Brenda.
Good morning, Baton Rouge.
Well, nice to talk with you, and I detect a bit of an accent, but you probably detect one on the other side of the microphone as well. Now, you are a survivor. 16, 17 years you've battled this with great resolve and success. How did you do it?
Wow, that is a loaded question, and I did it with great medical care, of course, and one day at a time, facing what I had to go through. I started noticing that humor was helping me along the way, so I started looking for funny things, and it helped me a lot.
And you've written several books, some of which have some curious titles. Why don't we go through some of the titles of your books to get us an impression of how Brenda keeps a smile on her face despite having had cancer?
Well, you know, I didn't go to college till after I had cancer. I was 42 when I went to college. I haven't finished yet. My aunt is 85, and she's a freshman in college right now, so I'll probably follow along her footsteps. But my first book I wrote in college, called If the Battle is Over, Why Am I Still in Uniform? And it's about going through colon cancer. I thought I'd leave it for my children. The second book was, I started realizing there are people that have all sorts of bowel issues, people with Crohn's disease, ulcerative colitis, and people that needed colostomies and ileostomies and urostomies. And I gathered all their stories across the country. I found 80 stories, and I put them in a book called I'd Like to Buy a Bowel, Please.
A little play on words there.
You got that. And then I realized, oh my gosh, well, if it wasn't for the doctors and the patients and the nurses and the caregivers, we wouldn't have great connections with people. So I looked for humor and inspiring medical stories in that book called Bedpan Banter. And then a medical company approached me to write one more, because people are afraid to talk about the intimacy, and how do you tell someone I have a colostomy or an ileostomy when you're dating or you just come home after having surgery. So that fourth book is called It's in the Bag and Under the Covers.
297-5633 if you'd like to join us. And Brenda Elsegier is a person who effuses enthusiasm and is optimistic, but I would imagine when you got your diagnosis and was there an operation involved?
There was. I was 39 years old, diagnosed with colorectal cancer. It's not something you hear every day. I just had a little pain in my tush, and I thought it was hemorrhoids. Turned out to be a lot worse than that. I had a tumor the size of a golf ball in my rectum. And yes, I just said that word rectum out loud in Baton Rouge, and we'll be saying it again tonight. Come on down.
Did you have other symptoms like bleeding, anything like that?
I did have a little bit of bleeding, but that's why I thought it was a hemorrhoid issue. I was a hairdresser at that time, and I thought, could I stand all day long? So you start to rationalize everything. I went to the doctor, and 3 weeks later, I had an operation, 7 hours long. Major operation, saved my life. but I ended up with a permanent colostomy at age 39. So the bag thing, I've been wearing the bag since I was 39, and it has actually saved my life, enhanced my life having that operation. So I always thought old people had colostomies and ileostomies and urostomies, and so I found out babies sometimes have to have them. And there's a lot of people in the United States walking around with ostomies today that are thriving.
Well, you seem very comfortable talking about this, and you can go to livingandlaughing.com and find out much more about Brenda, but it's something that many people don't like to talk about, particularly on the radio.
Oh, I think particularly anywhere. And, you know, I would say when I first started talking about this 16 years ago, people were real nervous when I started bringing up this subject. And now, in Minnesota at least, we have commercials on TV about it. And I think it's lunchtime conversation. I don't know that it's dinner time quite yet, but we're getting there.
Well, you say, and others do, that at age 50, that seems to be the magic mark that individuals should start getting colonoscopies. Is that once a year or once every 5 years? What's the drill here?
That is a great question. Colonoscopies are determined by the gastroenterologist once you've had your colonoscopy, depending on your results. Mm-hmm. So if you have a polyp, that's the greatest thing about having a colonoscopy. It is recommended at age 50, unless someone in your family has had a history with a colon issue. No one in my family had ever been diagnosed with cancer of any kind, so I don't think that was thought of for me.
So there wasn't a history of colon cancer in your family?
There wasn't. Ironically, a year after I was diagnosed, my uncle was diagnosed with colon cancer and died 3 months later. So colon cancer can be a very quiet, unassuming cancer. Nobody knows what's going on within their body, and all of a sudden they're in trouble. So age 50 is a recommended age. That's debating right now. Some people think it should be age 40 because there's so many people diagnosed at a younger age.
And if there's a family history?
You should start 10 years younger than that earliest diagnosis. So when I was 39, all my sisters 29 and up started getting colonoscopies.
My goodness. Mm-hmm. But at 39, most people don't think about this kind of thing.
They wouldn't think about it, but if you have symptoms of bleeding or the change in bowels, you definitely want to get in and just get it checked out.
Mm-hmm. 297-5633, question about Louisiana, and unfortunately this is another one of those categories, a dubious one in which we're ranked very high, I think fourth in the nation in the rates of colon cancer. Is there any particular environmental or lifestyle condition that causes this?
Yes, it could be several factors. If there's obesity in your state, obesity is one of the factors, high red meats, high fat foods, that has a contributing factor. I myself was overweight. That was my only connection to colon cancer. Alcohol, African American population seems to be the largest population that is not getting colonoscopies yet. They have the highest risk for some reason. So if you have a large African American population, that could contribute to it as well.
Only 60% of the people are getting screened. Where does that figure come from?
That's from the CDC.
Okay, yeah. So that means getting colonoscopies and that sort of thing?
Yeah, you want to definitely, the 60% has actually risen. And in about 10 years ago, about 2002, there was only 50% of our population in the United States getting colonoscopies. But then Katie Couric came out with that. She did a colonoscopy on screen. I don't know if you remember that. But in our area, in Minnesota, 75% increase in colonoscopies after she went on the air and did a live colonoscopy.
She did a great service.
We could be doing one right now on the radio. What do you think, Jim?
Well, maybe that's next.
How about it? You could try it.
All right. I'm into new experiences. 297-5633. Katie lost her husband
at
a young age to
Jay.
Colon cancer. And, mm-hmm. And apparently, like most people, just never got tested. And ultimately, when he found out he had it, it was too late to stop the path to the end. What about those who have these symptoms and ignore them, hoping they'll go away? We've had people on this show, and in fact, some good friends of mine who are now deceased who have had blood and just hoped that it would subside and not be a factor. And then by the time they found out what they had, sometimes it spreads to the liver. It's not a good thing, is it?
Well, that is true. I mean, obviously, the earlier detection is the best. You know, it's called treatable, beatable, preventable cancer by just getting a colonoscopy. So a colonoscopy can save your life because if you have a little polyp growing, like a little skin tag inside your colon, they snip it, it's gone, you're done. You know, and if you have a tumor or a polyp that turns out to be cancerous, Then you have early detection and you can treat it. And it's treatable and beatable by early detection.
Brenda Elsegier, comedian, author, national speaker. Her message is to triumph over adversity. And in her case, a 17-year triumph over colon cancer. And the author of 4 books on the subject. Tonight she'll be at the Pennington Center at 6 o'clock. And we're joined by the world-famous rabbi, Barry in Mid-City. Good morning, Barry. You're on the air with Brenda.
Good morning. Good morning, Brenda.
Hey, hi.
Hi. I wanted to say thank God for your health and healing and humor.
Oh, thank you.
And mention that I, along with thousands of others here in Baton Rouge, are survivors.
Beautiful.
I'm a survivor, thank God, of prostate cancer.
Beautiful.
And I wanted to mention that Cancer Services here does a tremendous job every year. In just a month, again, we'll have our Celebrate Life Day, honoring our physicians and nurses and medical attendants and those of us who are survivors. And I think that humor is so important. When I often speak and share on that day of celebration of life, I remind people of how during the catheter days after my operation, I talked about Kathy Catheter and how good friends we become.
That's great.
Well, you have kept your smile. Was it always that case? Did you come out of surgery with a smile on your face, or did it take some time to absorb this change in life? Thank you, Rabbi. Brenda, what do you think?
I think it's wonderful. Thank you for saying that, too, and thanks for bringing up Cancer Services, because here in Baton Rouge, you have this great organization called Cancer Services. Not every city has one, and from what I've experienced so far, and I'm going to look forward to meeting them this afternoon, they provide wonderful services to everybody, from counseling to ostomy support, exercise programs.
But what about the optimistic approach?
Oh, absolutely necessary. And I think I started looking for humor, and I found it right away in the hospital with talking to people. Would you like to hear a couple of little stories about that?
Sure.
First time I had my CAT scan, an older nurse hooked me up. Our beautiful young nurse hooked me up with the IV. And then you sit in a big CAT scan. It goes, breathe in, breathe out, hold your breath. And it takes a little while. And later on, this older nurse came and unhooked me from the IV. And she told me a story. And I was real nervous about that CAT scan. And she said, there was a guy in here last week, and the young nurse hooked him up. And I came and unhooked him. And he said, I knew I was in there a long time, but this is ridiculous. So that made me laugh really hard. And I laughed while I walked out. And that helped me in my first experience with it.
Jennifer on Florida asks, at what stage was your cancer diagnosed for you? Stage 2, 3, 4?
Well, at first it was stage 2, and then because it was all contained in the rectum, even though I had to have my rectum removed, it became stage 1.
So you caught it at a relatively
Well, it was a large tumor, but yes, it was caught early enough it had not gone outside the bowel wall. So I was originally scheduled for chemotherapy and radiation, and luckily I did not have to have either one of those.
And when it does spread, the chances of survival go down exponentially.
Oh, yes. I mean, it's more difficult, but there are stage 4 colon cancer survivors, so we never want to give up hope on that.
Yeah, there are.
And these days, too, you know, if it spreads to the liver or your lungs, they can be sected. And then in the early days when I was first told I had colon cancer, the doctor told me the cancer spread to your liver, your lungs. We won't bother to do the operation. We'll just make you as comfortable as possible. They don't ever say that now. It's much more hopeful.
Mm-hmm. How prevalent is it?
Oh, it is prevalent. I mean, there are 150,000 cases a year diagnosed in the United States. And I'd say that we're doing a good job, but it's still 40% of the people that have 40% specifically have colorectal cancer. And 50% of those, I don't know if it's 50 or 40%, will probably die from it if it's not caught early enough.
Mm-hmm. Well, if 150,000 people are diagnosed every year, then in Louisiana being an average-sized state, that'd be about 3,000 people in Louisiana.
Oh, good calculations.
Although, when I say average, we have a higher average on the percentage basis of colon cancer, so maybe it's 4,000 or 5,000 here in Louisiana. So it affects a great number of people and their families and friends. So it's something that we should be cognizant of, and we can find out much more about colon cancer tonight at 6 at the Pennington Center. And as Brenda stated, Cancer Services here in our area is always available for consultation, cancerservices.org or 225-927-2273. That's 225-927-2273. Thank you, Brenda.
Thank you so much.
Good to visit with you, and thanks for sharing your triumph over cancer.
Thank you.
And we'll return with Doug Baker from the Department of Revenue. Busy day for him and for the governor's staff. We'll find out why when we return in 90 seconds on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 877-217-5757 is your number. In the Baton Rouge calling area, it's 297-5633, and you may reach us by email, inkstershow@wrkf.org. In studio is Douglas Baker. He is a man about town these days, spreading the word of, at first, tax reform, and now let's hold the brakes on what lawmakers were deliberating. It looked like there might be some kind of bold compromise involving Democrats and Republicans at the Capitol. But the governor says what they were preparing to present to the masses was a tax increase. So it looks like the GOP side of the deliberations is now in the governor's camp, and Doug is coming here perhaps as a triumphant man this time. Last time he was carrying the water for a plan that did not fly regarding the tax swap. Good morning again, Doug Baker.
Well, good morning, Jim. Thank you for having me back.
You're smiling a lot more this time.
Well, when last we were at the microphone together, we were talking about the merits of the governor's tax reform package, which were many and legion, as I tried to articulate during my time with you at that point. Following that encounter, we had some unexpected turbulence there, and the governor decided to park the bills in hopes that the legislature themselves would come up with a way to eliminate income tax for Louisiana taxpayers. But evidently, Chairman Robideau had another action to do, and now we sit on this side of that experience, and we realize that now there seems to be a tax increase in the making, and to which it is a surprise for all of us to encounter this. We found out 2 nights ago. We'd heard rumors of this, as the governor had said a secret plan was in place. We just didn't know how secret. But when it emerged, some of us wanted to keep it secret in many ways, because it certainly is something that I can hardly believe is emerging from those who purport themselves to be economic and fiscal conservatives.
Well, Doug, if you did not hear his first visit on this show, is a person who spent a lot of time in Louisiana through the years, graduate of LSU, and he returned to his home state from Union University. He served as assistant to the provost at that university, and he also worked for former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee for a few years as his special assistant. Doug holds a BA from LSU in education, a Master's of Divinity from the New Orleans Baptist Theological Seminary, and an MA in government and public policy from Johns Hopkins University in the great city of Baltimore, Maryland. And he has been out making his case for tax reform, and now has reversed course and is saying, let's not go too far in tax increases. Why are these exemptions, if we fund them at 85%, why would that constitute a tax increase?
Well, before I came, Jim, I went to the library and picked up an essay, actually an old book that was published in 1953 that I was required reading for us at Hopkins, and it was by two economic progressives, self-described economic progressives, Walter Blum and Henry Kaplan, who wrote a wonderful little treatise in 1953 called The Uneasy Case.
60 years ago.
That's right. That's right. Before the
you
Great
were
Society.
Born,
exactly.
Doug.
That's right. Old books are best, Jim. Old books are best. And this is before the Great Society.
Like the Bible, right?
I'm sorry?
Like the Bible.
Exactly. But the little essay we had to read was The Uneasy Case for Progressive Taxation. There was a time, once upon a time, when even self-styled progressives were nervous about raising taxes in any way, because they understood that to do so could easily destabilize an economy, whether at the state or the national level. Now, post the discussions of the governor's tax reform plan, and we were committed to no tax increases to make it as revenue neutral and to make sure that there was no added burden to Louisianans, we're finding out now that this purported plan that is being brought out by members of the fiscal hawks in the House, and this, what we're terming to almost be a grand bargain to raise taxes, is indeed going to do that by upwards of some $350, some $400 million.
297-5633. Doug Baker, who is a man, last guest was enthusiastic. This guy is enthusiasm on steroids, and he is a believer of what he is speaking. You have subscribed to this ideology that taxes are a very bad thing. Are taxes ever good? Do they ever accomplish anything?
Well, I'm always going to go with Chief Justice Marshall, who I read again, an old Supreme Court justice, who always said that with the power to tax comes the power to destroy. And I'm always reminded in the way, since I haven't seen you, Jim, when Margaret Thatcher has passed away, I remember meeting her at Union University one time, and she rehearsed again and restated her famous quote from October 1983 that said this: "There is no such thing as public money. There is only taxpayer money." So when we talk about taxes, we need to understand that's not coming from nebulous phantoms out there. It's emerging from people in their pockets, taking from their pockets for the public good. Now, of course, we want to have good infrastructure and roads, and we want to have health care, we want to have higher education, which is the very reason why this plan is so dangerous, because it sucks money out of the economy at a time when we're actually getting things in order. And since the governor's emerged in office, has actually got so many gains for economic development that why this would even be put out as a positive is beyond my imagination.
But,
it's preposterous.
Okay, we're going to go to the calls and take a few
I'm
emails
sure there's
as well.
Some.
And but the governor himself was calling for some of these exemptions to go away a few weeks ago. Now, it was a swap. But if it was good under any circumstance, why would it not be good under another circumstance?
There were 4 to 5 months of careful deliberations examining every exemption. Indeed, the Revenue Study Commission, formed by the House and Senate, a combined committee there, to be able to study with great detail these exemptions. Many of them, some economic drivers for the state, which emerge in ways that keep us moving forward economically. The governor's plan never raised taxes, and the swap of which you mentioned, let me borrow your words there, was with the elimination of income tax, the elimination of corporate tax, the elimination of corporate franchise tax, to a point of a consumption tax based upon a broad base of services. This plan does nothing of the sort. This plan actually subtracts money from businesses and taxpayers, takes it back into a government economy at the very time the private sector economy in Louisiana is emerging and is fuel for further expansion.
A question from a listener, and we will go to the phone lines.
Sure.
In just a moment, 297-5633. Neil asks how long you worked for Governor Huckabee.
I worked for Governor Huckabee 2.5 years before I went to Washington, D.C., back when he went in his first term and into his second term around the 1998, 1999, into 2000.
So this was early Huckabee.
It was early Huckabee, that's right.
John in Lafayette. John, good morning. You're on the air with Doug Baker from the Louisiana Department of Revenue.
Yes, good morning, Mr. Baker.
Good morning.
I had a short comment and then a short question. The comment has to do with the Louisiana Business Association, the organization that Dan Juneau represents.
Yes, LABI, sir, that's right. Yes,
yeah,
sir.
And the, right, LABI.
Yes.
And the Louisiana Chemical Association,
yes.
Mr. Bornet's organization. Both of those organizations are opposed to what the fiscal hawks are trying to do. And they were also opposed to Governor Jindal's tax reform plan. So I look at them as being selfish bullies who exploit Louisiana, a bunch of out-of-state corporations who exploit Louisiana as a colony. So that's my comment. My question is, what about, you touched on this, the study committee that the legislature formed to look at all these tax exemptions, didn't they come back and suggest that 50 of these tax exemptions could be eliminated and recommend that they be eliminated?
Well, Dan Juneau and Dan Bornet can certainly defend themselves as, again, being exploiters of the colony of Louisiana. I think this these exploitations of which you reference employ thousands of Louisianans and give them very good-paying jobs in a way that the oil and gas industry and the chemical industry, I think many of those employees might beg to differ with you about how they're exploiting their lives and making their lives more heinous insofar as that's their livelihood. Second, as to your question about the exemptions, it is universally accepted by economists that the best way to understand and to best administer a tax code is to have it simpler, fairer, and flatter. Does it sound familiar, Jim? We've been down this road before. We talked to the legislators about this. This plan, of which they have put forward, is none of those things. It is willy-nilly. It is nothing in a way that what Tim Barfield, my boss, and the governor did by talking with various groups over time to be able to carefully engender a plan together that would be put forth to the public in a way that these exemptions would not cause trauma to business and to individuals.
297-5633. Thank you, John in Lafayette. Still time to talk with Doug Baker, who will be with us for a while longer. 877-217-5757 outside Baton Rouge. And a question to Inkster Show at WRKF.org from Judy, she says, why is it secretive and not listening to the people when the legislators are developing plans and part of the deliberative process when the governor and his department heads don't keep us, the people, informed?
Well, I would take issue with that because Tim Barfield and Governor Jindal were at work months and months ahead of time. Tim met with countless hundreds of people across the state, chambers of commerce, various areas of education. He met with anyone that wanted to talk with him, even remotely. The governor met with every legislator in the mansion. He talked with them. He showed them the plan, which is amazing to me when we have people like Representative John Schroeder who will go to the well of the House of Representatives and accuse the governor of money laundering and basically say that this plan is too much to be taken in 60 to 90 days when it looks like to me, as he said, I feel like I have a gun to my head. It's amazing to me Representative Schroeder is the very one that's purporting this plan almost to be coming out in 60 to 90 minutes. So I think we've been very open with our understanding of how this plan should go forward and the way that Chairman Robideau passed these bills out, reported them unfavorably to the House floor, is rarely done, Jim. It's only been done once in this session, April 17th on one bill. Then we had to go back all the way to 2007 to find two more bills that it's been done this and these parliamentary tactics like this. And of course, you might guess that Chairman Robideau did it back then as well.
Is he in trouble? Is he going to lose his chairmanship?
I have no knowledge of that. He's not in trouble with me or the governor, but
he's not.
Not to my knowledge, he's not. And but the chairman certainly has. Let's just say he set on a course that could certainly call into question his ability to understand how this is going to move forward.
It sounds like he might be in trouble then.
Oh, I didn't say that. I just said it could call into question his administration.
Like it.
Well, that's
like
good.
It.
Good guy.
Okay.
Point well taken, Jim. Point well taken.
Okay. Well. John in New Road says, is there any way to compute the tax revenue loss due to the governor refusing the federal broadband money, the federal high-speed rail money, and the Medicaid money?
Well, let me speak to Medicaid on that. I'm not an expert in this area of policy, but I do find it interesting that Senator Karen Carter-Peterson, when she was putting these ideas out, that the governor, unlike some of his other Republican governors across the nation, refused this money, particularly Governor Scott in Florida, who's a wonderful man and doing a very good job, who accepted that money. The Florida legislature themselves studied this issue. They looked out across 5 to 10 years, of which this documentation would flow in a financial model, and did not allow these funds to go forward themselves. So to understand these ideas and understand the basic budgeting tactics of some of these federal government programs is often to invite disaster to the state budget. We don't need to be growing the coffers of government money. We need to be growing the coffers of the private sector so that good-paying jobs can continue to increase in the state of Louisiana, which I know we all want.
So you think the Medicaid expansion is a bad thing?
Of course, my boss does. I do. I've seen some of the delineations of how that works itself out over years. And the worst thing you can do, as President Reagan often said, the nearest thing to eternal life on this earth is a government program.
Now, is there ever a case, Doug, you being a bright man, where you say, boss, I don't think you're right here?
Do you think I would tell you that, Jim, if I ever said that?
You might.
Not on the public program. Oh, no.
Well, you still are sent out to make the case. And sometimes, as you found out, one case is easier to make than another. And this time around, when you're against taxes, you got people saying, good way to go, Doug. A few weeks ago, when you were talking about raising some taxes, a swap, but still raising some taxes, you had people saying, what are they doing over there?
Well, Jim, let me just pick at your words and respectfully disagree. I don't think, I have not said, Tim has not said, the governor has never said that we would raise taxes, ever.
Sure you did.
When?
Well, you were talking about raising some taxes as an offset to lowering others.
Well, let me, you said the operative word there, as an offset.
But
the governor
you're still
never
going to raise some taxes.
The governor never entertained a tax increase of any kind unless it was purported in a way that would be put forward as an offset to revenue neutrality.
Well, if there's a payroll at the Department of Revenue, which yes. I'm sure there is, and Doug Baker gets a $20,000 raise and
be nice.
It would, wouldn't it? And somebody else will probably have to get a $20,000 decrease to keep it revenue neutral. That's what we were talking about. Mm-hmm. So
well, okay,
aren't we splitting hairs here?
I don't think so. I think, can we take it out of the government economy where the government bureaucracy cannot grow itself only with taxpayer money? Can we put it into the private sector where that if I could create something or create new jobs, that the raise that would come forth to me as an employee in a private sector job would be governed by and administered based upon my ability and creativity to produce, administrate, and actually give something back in the way of my productivity.
You're making a very eloquent case for tax increases.
Not at all. I'm saying I'm giving private sector economy a chance to flourish in a place where it's not being sucked out by taxing agents.
Okay, well, but isn't there also a cost to reducing the size of government? That affects people, it affects jobs, it affects services, hospitals, higher education. Isn't there a cost to doing that, particularly to the economy?
Well, what you're going to find out, the way the government has shrunk under the General Administration for about $9 billion in a way that we're doing more with less because there's less money to do. And that's not necessarily a fault of not taxing people more. It's a way of putting more money into the economy. And I don't need to remind anyone here, we've endured a lot together as a state. I was not here for Katrina. I was in Washington, D.C., but watching in horror on the television as I saw that and the aftermath of all that took place. Of course, we had what was termed the Great Recession, the largest type of economic meltdown since the Great Depression at the turn of the last century. These types of catastrophic economic events are going to impact the economy both nationally, as we have seen, and continue to see today, as well as a state. Thankfully, however, Louisiana has fared better than most of our peers in the Southeast. We're one of 11 states in the nation that actually have more jobs now than we did prior to the Great Recession.
Okay, I think Secretary Moray and Governor Jindal, yes, they deserve a lot of credit for the economic growth that we've had, particularly new industries like IBM coming to Louisiana, and that has been stated here. Are these tax exemptions a necessity for attracting those kinds of people to come to Louisiana?
Incentivizing tax money is always a carefully done job. And the job of the Secretary of Economic Development of the governor is to make sure the tax code is structured in a way that could help not become a barrier to any business that wants to expand here. I dare say you're going to have an expansion like you have in the Lake Charles area over in Calcasieu Parish with Sisal and all that's coming out with gas to liquids and all the ethane cracker complex they're going to do there in a way that's going to basically rebuild in some of that economy and that portion of the state to upwards of $20 billion with basically direct jobs, 1,250 direct jobs, and with vendors that come around that, with all the other agencies that come around and help support that ship, could be up to $5,000 or $6,000. The state does make it possible in a way to make sure that the cost associated with that relocation is helpful to that business. As Dan Bornais said to the world yesterday when he stood in the governor's conference room there, he said he held up a proposal from a foreign country that was trying to get American businesses to relocate abroad because they were trying to do everything they could to bring jobs to their country. We're in an internationally competitive market, and if we do not position ourselves and continue to do so in a way that will attract jobs, we will not be competitive and retain those jobs.
Well, today's top story in The Advocate, one of them, below the court derailing the voucher law, alternate budget plan in jeopardy from Michelle Milholland. Cracks appeared among House Republicans on Tuesday as Governor Jindal and business groups worked furiously against an alternative state spending plan. State Representative Brett Guyman, Republican Lake Charles, said some party members are having trouble committing to a plan that would generate $329 million for the state budget by reducing tax breaks. The plan would also cut state government spending by more than $100 million. So it looks like the tax compromise is in trouble, and we'll return with Doug in 90 seconds. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Thank you for being with us. Kevin Gallagher is producing, and we're going to spend some more quality time with Doug Baker, as spokesman. What is the official title? You're a deputy secretary, right?
No. I'm just director of communications for the Department of Revenue.
And usually it's like deputy secretary in charge of communications, but you are now director of communications. That's right. A good title to have. And was a special assistant to Governor Mike Huckabee for 2.5 years in the great city of Little Rock. What did you do for Governor Huckabee?
Well, I did speech writing, policy, and then I was promoted to Secretary of the Cabinet. So I basically coordinated all the cabinet secretaries and the policy with that, and I continued to help him with his speech writing. Well, he's a great speaker, so it was a very enjoyable time for me to help him with those endeavors.
Here's this question from John Williams. He says, could Mr. Baker comment if the state has increased spending for treatment of AIDS in Louisiana?
I do not know that, sir, but I'm sure if you'll contact the Department of Health and Hospitals, They'll be happy to tell you that and give you that information.
Well, Doug probably knows where every dollar in state government goes. And
state government is too big, Jim, so we're no one probably knows where every dollar goes except for the Commissioner of Administration, probably.
The Commissioner of Administration?
I'm sure.
Okay. The state Supreme Court yesterday derailed the state's expanded voucher program, setting off a scramble in the legislature on how to fund the voucher program. That's another cost of doing business. How are you going to do that without some sort of offset on the other side?
Well, I will leave that to the governor and Superintendent White to be able to talk about that. I know the governor yesterday in a press conference when he was talking about the proposed tax increase plan by the House, talked about this and is committed to rescuing children out of who are trapped in failing schools. So he's committed to doing that. I know parents who were involved with their children out of failing schools are going to do that. So I will leave that to him to be able to outline and to delineate these types of funding mechanisms.
Got to have the money somewhere, though.
Well, I'm going to leave that to him. I'm sure there's ways to do that, and I'm sure the governor is more adept than me to talk about that.
HB in Denham Springs. Hi, HB. You're on the air with Doug Baker.
Good morning. My statement is this, number one. Given the inflation factor on the median income family in Louisiana, which I think is about $40,000, and everything that the family has to be committed to having in the state of Louisiana with a home, car, and everything else, when does the till run dry on disposable income on the average taxpayers? Thank you, sir.
Well, you bring up an interesting point, sir, and thank you for your call. If you were to look at national trends, you find out, and you will soon discover, that the middle class or middle income families have their income has basically become stagnant because so many costs are associated with just living expenses in many ways based upon federal taxes and the outlay for many necessities of life. Thankfully, in the Louisiana tax code, as we were purported to keep in our plan when it was operative in ways of the legislature, would keep prescriptions and prescription drugs, food for home consumption, and fuel and residential utilities out of the mix in a way that would at least give some relief to that. But I think that's going to be a national problem as we move forward. I think that middle-class income is going to continue to be a problem in a way that because many people are not seeing the rise in their incomes as they want to. And I think that has a direct correlation to national tax policy. And we can thank Senator Baucus, who is being reported this morning in the Washington Post, that he is actually convening a national tax force to talk about tax reform at the federal level.
Today's Advocate editorial, the top one, says Jindal could set example. It reads, "We're not the only observers, of course, who were struck by the irony of Governor Bobby Jindal accusing state lawmakers of secrecy in making their decisions. The governor should honor the ideal of openness in formulating his own policy proposals. Now's the time for Jindal to lead by example." Do you think we should have more transparency in government from this administration?
I think the governor's been very transparent in everything that he has done. I think in the education initiative that he put forth, I think he had time for the public to comment on the legislation in committee. I think there were opportunities for people to give voice and opinion to what they thought would be happening as that was moving through. With the tax reform legislation, it was nothing but transparency in a way that we had to put forth by order of the Speaker of the House, or at least the request of the Speaker of the House, that we would, about 3 to 4 weeks before session, put forth the ideas contained therein. And we did that.
All right, but the governor has successfully advocated changes in the public records law that shield more records from public view. Are there some records that should be off base to the people at large?
Well, I think if you look, let's take the President of the United States. The Bush Library just opened a few weeks ago in Dallas, Texas, on the campus of Southern Methodist University, and I had connection with the Bush White House. And while in office, if you're looking for advice and counsel by your closest staff, cabinet secretaries and other close staff, in a way that would deliberate critical issues that could obviously affect the lives of people, when you want those shielded from people to be able to see those types of things, at least while you're in office, I would think you would, in a way that would at least not compromise the integrity of the counsel the governor or a chief executive in government would receive.
That's your opinion, but there are others. And of course, I must say, as a disclaimer, that that many journalists who jump on through the other side, they change their tune on this. But most journalists would want transparency complete, total. Mm-hmm. You're a public servant, so I should know if I wanted to. I should be able to get your cell phone, find out who you're calling, who you're emailing. You're okay with that, aren't you?
Well, Jim, it would be a very boring experience for you to see my cell phone numbers and my email, personal email, or really probably my office email, for that matter. But for chief executive officers who serve at the state of Louisiana or others in our federal government, I think they should have the privilege, executive privilege, to be able to deliberate and to contemplate and to discuss serious issues with their top staff without interference and or intimidation by journalists who would try to, in some ways, silence that discussion from taking place. Of course, I wonder if the tables were turned, Jim, that if we could get a Freedom of Information request from some journalists that I know, that would be fun to read, I must say, Jim, if that were to ever happen. I wonder if you'd be open to that. Perhaps we should introduce a bill next session for Freedom of Information Act for journalists. Would you be open for that?
Wear yourself out.
Okay, all right. I expect full support from the Jim Engster Show. Should we be able to do that, Jim?
Okay,
just kidding, everyone. Just kidding.
Question from Delia. Why does the Department of Revenue and Taxation, along with other state government agencies controlled by the governor, need its own communications office?
Well, there are a lot of issues that come through our offices every day. There are issues of the public that must be adjudicated, and all kinds of things come through there that call for our best communication to the public. Taxes are a complicated issue, unfortunately, and we're there to make sure that they're synthetic in a way that they can understand them at least transparently. Can I borrow your word, Jim? And in a way that they can understand our initiatives without fear of misunderstanding.
James on Airline. Hi, James. You're on the air with Douglas Baker.
Hi. First, a quick response to the lies about transparency, and then I'll get to my main point.
Please be brief.
To shroud Mr. Gentle's secrecy under the guise of deliberative process is more than ridiculous. But I have an analogy about the pizza store that I used to run. Let's say I served really great pizzas, sold them for $4, but they cost me $4.25 to make, and I had really happy customers and was losing money every month. That's not very sustainable. So extending that to the business of government, shouldn't the government raise enough revenue to be able to produce a useful product in terms of all the things your guests listed, education, healthcare, higher ed?
Sir, thank you for your call. The difference is in this, is that your business raises money and you are in charge in a way of making that business work and expand in a way for you to make a profit. A government cannot make profit. It has no money of its own. It can only get money from you, the taxpayer. Therefore, as we seek to expand government, it's only going to take money from the taxpayer. It is always unwise to do so without careful deliberation. And in this day and age, I believe that government does not need to expand, but it needs to shrink in a way that would at least live within its means so that the private sector economy can flourish in a way unimpeded by government taxation.
What about the budget? If there is no compromise from lawmakers, and obviously the governor does not want the compromise that they were deliberating, where do you get the money to pay for government services?
Well, this is obviously a question for the Speaker of the House and the Chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee to be able to articulate and to present a path forward. The governor has presented a budget. He has done so with integrity in a way that is balanced. There is no such thing as deficit spending in the state government, unlike the federal government. The budget will be balanced by law. He must make sure, and his officers, the Commissioner of Administration and others, must make sure that at the end of the day, at the end of the fiscal year, the budget balances. While it's uncomfortable to make mid-year cuts, as has to be done with that, it is against the law to run a deficit in state government. So what we understand is it now is residing in the hands of a legislature to be able to deliberate between themselves and to either pass a budget or tell the people that they refuse to do so.
Julie at the Capitol wants to know if you're still planning on selling those state buildings. Is that part of the budget mechanism as far as funding it?
As I understand it, that is part of the governor's budget there, and things are moving along. I did not look at that before I came on, but if you will call the DOA's office there, I'm sure they'll be able to articulate that for you and make sure that you are up to date on that.
How much could the state raise if we sold the mansion?
Solar Governor's Mansion?
Yeah.
I don't know if it's been appraised, but perhaps you have some friends
well,
to
has,
do that.
It has
you know?
Great sentimental value
it
and
does.
Historic
it's
value.
Yes,
and
I doubt
I'm
you
not being,
sell
I'm not
it,
being
Jim.
Flippant here.
I understand that.
Jerry Brown was governor of California the first time.
Yes.
He wouldn't move in the governor's mansion.
Right.
He said it
right.
was a monstrosity.
Mm-hmm.
He moved. He lived in an $80 apartment then.
Mm-hmm.
The governor, being the fiscal conservative that he is, our governor, he could really set an example if we sold the mansion and he moved to maybe the Capitol Lake Apartments just a few blocks away. Do you think that would fly?
Now, Jim, surely you don't want to take Jim Brown as an example. Jim Brown just passed the largest tax increase in California's history.
Jim Brown?
Jerry Brown. Excuse me. I'm sorry, Jim Brown. I'm thinking of Campbell's dad there, the former Secretary of State of Louisiana.
And
I apologize
number
about
32
that.
For the Cleveland Browns.
Exactly. That's right. But you certainly don't want to take Governor Brown of California as a paradigm for good governance, do you?
Yes, I actually like Jerry Brown.
Do you really? Well,
I do.
People are fleeing California in droves. Because
that's why
the
they have 38 million people who live in California and 4.5 million who live in Louisiana.
Well, right? I think if you'll check the population records and the trends that are moving out of that state, you'll find that I'm right. People are fleeing that state because of its high tax rates.
Well, I would bet you that more people moved to California in the last 6 years than moved to Louisiana.
Unfortunately, that may be the case, but we're trying to fix that through making sure that we don't have tax increases in the state of Louisiana so we can have good business and good jobs for them to come to one of the best states of the union.
Well, you're an eloquent man and a good sport.
Well, that's debatable, but
yeah,
I appreciate
it. And
that.
I enjoy spending time with you on the air.
As do I, sir.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Doug Baker, and best of luck to you and the staff as you make your case to state lawmakers. And apparently this time around, lawmakers are saying the governor has the mojo and we're on board. We're not going to raise taxes, at least not the way that we had thought we would. 297-5633. The last few moments of the show today, I wanted to talk about House Bill 567 from Eric Ponte, who's a good lawmaker. He's been on this show, but some folks are not enthused about this particular legislation that would repeal Louisiana's prohibition against for-profit debt adjusters. And with us to discuss it is Bill Charbonnet. He is the Louisiana State Chairman of the National Association of Consumer Bankruptcy Attorneys and an officer of the Louisiana State Bar Association's Consumer Law Section. Good morning to you, sir.
Hey, Jim. How you doing? I really like the idea about selling the governor's mansion.
Well, I'm being serious here.
I am too.
I think you could get $50 million for that building.
I don't know if you'd get that much, but
I think
I guarantee you could because of the
historic value of the mansion, in addition to the fact that it's a very nice place, I think it would go for about $50 million.
So Edwin Edwards could have his TV show out of there. You know?
Well, now let's not go too far. But what about this bill that you're up in arms about? Repealing the ban against for-profit debt adjusters?
Well, there's a couple of things. First of all, it would open Louisiana up to these debt settlement companies, these out-of-state debt companies who come in, they advertise on television that people have a right to settle their debt for pennies on the dollar. They don't. They encourage people to break legitimate contracts. They tell their customers to stop paying their bills because the credit card companies aren't going to go and negotiate with them if they're making any payments. So they basically practice law. They're not from Louisiana. They're not qualified to do so. The Louisiana State Bar Association is opposed to HB 567 because they also believe that it constitutes the practice of law. And I should be in favor of this as a bankruptcy attorney because I can tell you we see the bodies that these people leave by the side of the road. They suck people into debt settlement companies, take their money up front in fees, and then by the time the people are sued or garnished or have a lien on their house, they're unable to take advantages of the provisions of Chapter 13 and sometimes wind up in a straight Chapter 7 bankruptcy.
Well, how many other states have this ban?
Well, I don't know exactly how many. Almost every state has either licensing or a ban. We have licensing, but they're getting rid of that right now. Representative Ponte is just going to eliminate the Financial Planning and Management Services Act that has been the law since 1970, and he's replacing it with kind of like a Cub Scout honor or Boy Scout honor system of registration. Just imagine what would happen if we didn't have driver's licenses, and we said anybody can drive a car if you register your car. And all that could happen if you run through a school zone or drive drunk is that the Attorney General can file a suit against you in civil court. That's kind of what Representative Ponte's bill is going to do.
And where does it stand in the legislative process right now?
It's coming up for a vote at 2 o'clock this afternoon. And,
full House, right?
Yes, sir.
So it's past committee.
No, it's it passed committee because it's Representative Ponte's committee, and it did in fact get out of committee. It has come up twice before in the last 2 weeks, and it was withdrawn because Representative Ponte did not have enough votes to get it passed. I think today is the final shot that they have at trying to get it through this session of the legislature. And I think it's going to be interesting watching.
Well, the lawmakers in their wisdom have been reluctant to reduce interest rates on these payday loan places in Louisiana. Something like this, why would they be against it? If they're for these payday loans, which charge exorbitant rates, why would they be in favor of your stand on this particular issue?
Well, first of all, payday loans are exorbitant, and they shouldn't be allowed.
All right, I'm sorry. We got to go, but thank you for your sentiments and expressions, and we'll return tomorrow. Until then, for Kevin, I'm Jim. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.